From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells. Once schools shuttered in the early days of the pandemic, educators quickly discovered the possibilities and limits of distance learning technologies. Months later, it's obvious that the bright points of learning technology are substantially offset by the loss of schools as places for camaraderie, shelter, nutrition, social services, teaching and learning. Many things that happen in schools, well, they simply cannot happen at a distance. Our guest is the director of the MIT Teaching Systems Lab, Justin Reich, who has written a book on the topic called Failure to Disrupt, While Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Justin joins us now. Justin, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, it's really good to have you. We very much enjoyed your book. Let's talk about learning. And you mentioned one of the there's a lot of moving pieces to this, but one of the things you mentioned is that people that are most successful in these self-paced courses are also those who are also successful in school. They're self-motivated. They're academically well prepared. These are challenges for kids that that are involved in this online learning. Can you talk about that?
Sure. There's kind of a remarkable paradox with online learning, which is my guess is that most of your listeners will identify with the experience of having something that they're really excited about learning more about, going online, and being successful learning about it. And so whether that's learning how to style your hair or do makeup in a new way or to beat a level in a video game or to fix your snow thrower or whatever it is, when there are things that we're really motivated to learn, people, including people of all ages, are actually quite good at learning online. The irony, though, is that when we ask people to pursue learning experiences that are more like things that are required for school, many of us struggle with that. Many of us struggle with having the self-regulation, the executive function, the motivation to pursue learning by ourselves. And so there are some people who are good at this. They tend to be people who are already really good learners. Online learning tends to work pretty well for people who would learn well anywhere. However, for younger students, for students who are historically not well served by school systems, online learning is really hard, and it's really hard because you're taken away from the immediate presence of teachers, of peers, and those social supports are just incredibly important for learning.
Does it have to do with an interest in the subject? I mean, if you have a broken water pump on your car and you're incented to fix it and you go online and you see a tutorial that shows you how to do that, or you're really interested in learning how to play guitar and you take online guitar courses versus mathematics, which people, in, for the most part, are not really interested in learning about.
Yeah, motivation is an incredibly important feature of how we create effective learning. For a lot of students, for a lot of people, motivations for learning are really social. You know, I've been thinking about during the pandemic and all the challenges people have had with remote learning, it's just how many things happen in schools, in the buildings of schools, that we take for granted. If a third grader is feeling a little bit bored, a little bit not interested in what she's doing, and she picks her head up in a classroom, she looks around, and she sees a bunch of other kids with their heads down doing whatever it is they're supposed to doing, and she looks up at the teacher, and the teacher looks back and gives her kind of a smile, but one of those, like, what exactly are you doing smiles, and that girl is reasonably likely to be like, ah, okay. Back doing whatever it is I'm supposed to be doing. If you're at home trying to learn through an iPad and you pick your head up and look around, there's like a refrigerator in the corner full of snacks, and there's a Nintendo Switch that you could be playing with, and there's like four other apps that are more interesting on your iPad. Our homes are not designed to do the kind of structured, targeted learning that we have happen in schools. I was talking with an elementary school principal who said what we're learning is that there's 500 or 1,000 things that we do every day, verbal and nonverbal, to make class work, and none of them work over Zoom.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Justin Reich. His book is called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Justin, it seems like the sound, you're coming in and out a little bit. So if there's anything you can do to improve your connection, that would be great. Again, this is also one of the issues with online learning is the technology isn't perfect, right? And all of us have been on, whether it's a Zoom call or some sort of technology fail comes along. And it's really hard for those who have difficulty with focus, for example, to kind of adapt to when things go awry. I've seen people just completely give up in frustration on a virtual call of some sort. And I just thought I'd mention that because we all, no one's immune to technology failures. So how much does that figure in?
I think it matters enormously. There have been a bunch of videos that people have been sharing on social media of teachers trying to coach, especially young children, through the difficult interactions of operating technology. Many of us who have spent a lot of time on video conferencing know the experience of trying to get everyone but one person to mute themselves. One consequence of those things is that they take a while. An interaction that might normally happen between a teacher and a student that could take, 5 or 6 seconds, if there's a whole bunch of fiddling around, it can take 30 or 45 or 60. Our school days are not that long. Our class periods are not that long. Those delays are really consequential. And then there's all kinds of other challenges. We have not built an incredibly robust broadband infrastructure in this country. There are millions of school-age children who live in homes that are not well connected to the internet. Many of our schools and many of our classrooms are not well connected to the internet. So there's also lots of stories going around of teachers getting kicked offline and coming back to sort of Lord of the Flies-like circumstances in their video conferencing services where, everyone has changed their name and are chanting crazy things and other kinds of things like that. And it's, to some extent, it's great that children are taking these opportunities to express themselves and to play out their frustrations, but there's lots that we do in schools that we take for granted to make the day work, and they're really difficult to do online.
Well, it's interesting that you talk about that, Justin, because I think it's very interesting. So you're saying it's okay that the teacher gets kicked offline, comes back on, the kids are doing something rebellious and creative and imaginative. And isn't this one of the components of online learning that we just haven't really figured out? Patience, tolerance, resilience, how to adapt when things go awry.
Sure. And I think another problem for teachers and students in those circumstances is that we don't count all learning equally in schools. The Utah Department of Education and legislature have a set of expectations of what children are supposed to learn, and those are sort of codified into curriculum and standards. And the expectation is that students will make progress towards those standards. Over the last 9 months, there has been much less progress towards those standards, but it doesn't mean that the children and teachers interacting aren't learning all kinds of things. I think children have had incredible opportunities to learn about operating technology, communicating with each other about technology, developing skills for independent learning and self-regulated learning. But the issue is that, in some respects, they were supposed to be learning sound letter mappings and how to factor polynomials and the causes of the Civil War and those kinds of things. Mm-hmm. And so there's, it creates a certain amount of anxiety in which you're doing great learning, but not exactly the learning you were supposed to be doing.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Justin Reich, who's written a book on the topic called Failure to Disrupt: Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Justin, my career in technology put me on the road all the time. I was constantly traveling, and I was always fascinated, and I used to think about, wouldn't it be great to get off the road and not have to, some meetings you've got to be in person, especially on the sales side. But I was curious why the adoption rates of video conferencing and all its iterations and the promise of video conferencing and how it was going to change our lives never really came to be. And then when Cisco came out with the telepresence, which you know, synced up the audio better so that there wasn't cadence problems and things like that, I thought, well, maybe that'll be it, but it didn't. But then when COVID hit, we didn't have a choice, and we had to use these tools. And I found that I can have Zoom meetings 3, 4, 5, 15 people and make it productive now and actually make it work. It actually adopt this technology because we don't have a choice. And I'm curious, you know, I mean, they always said that necessity is the mother of invention. Maybe necessity is also the mother of adoption, and that there are other technologies that we've just never really been able to get to work, but that we're now going to be able to adopt. What do you think about that?
I think it's certainly more likely to be true in sectors outside of education. I think people routinely underestimate how complicated, how sophisticated the work of teaching and learning is. So in a lot of, you know, marketing meetings, sales meetings, you're trying to communicate information back and forth, but you're not trying to build the capacity necessarily of other people. It's very rare that we have these interactions where there's one person really responsible for the development or the changing of thinking of 25 or 30 other people. And so teaching and learning are really different. One of the core things that we do in schools is that we watch one another. We watch how people read a text. We watch closely how their mouths move, how they express themselves, how we react to other people's thinking. We listen really carefully to other people's ideas in the best of circumstances. You know, for some of the things that we do in elementary grades, we watch very closely how a child's hand moves over a piece of paper to form a letter or to tie their shoes or other kinds of things like that. And video conferencing technology doesn't do a very good job of giving us high resolution on all of those kinds of things. It's hard to see other people. It's especially hard to see 25 or 30 people in the way that a teacher typically does in the classroom. So I think we're certainly going to find some applications of these tools. You know, as some folks have said, snow days may become a thing of the past, and especially in well-connected, you know, broadband-connected communities like Park City. It may be different out in more rural areas. But I also think that, you know, if a vaccine appeared today, there would be an awful lot of students and an awful lot of teachers that would be very, very happy to be able to get back and be together with one another, because we still haven't developed technologies that do all of the things that we want to be able to happen in classrooms.
And you write in your book that technologies tend to be most useful for affluent students. And I looked online this morning, 6% of people in the United States still don't have internet. Now, some of that's because it's rural and they don't have access, but some of it's because they can't afford it. And they take that $50 a month and they put it towards food because that's what they need to do for their family. And then if they can't afford internet, the chances are they are working a couple of jobs. They're a mom and a dad that are or a single parent working two jobs, and their kids don't have access to be able to get to the libraries where the internet is set up. So how do we get around some of these challenges so that there's access for everybody?
Well, one of the most unfortunate pieces of rhetoric that I've heard in numerous ways during the pandemic is the notion that these are problems that schools are meant to fix. You know, like the principal in Ogden is not going to be rolling fiber optic cable up the holler to connect, remote homes on the mountainside. Schools cannot solve all of the social problems that we have with children and families in this country. There are other parts of our government, there are other parts of our society that have to address these issues. In the early 20th century, we said as a country, every home should be connected to electricity. And, you know, we didn't go to the local and superintendent and say, you know, your kids can't read at night, so we're really going to need you to electrify rural homes. Instead, state governments, the federal government in particular, played a big role in making a massive infrastructure project to be able to connect every home to electricity. And we should do the same thing with broadband internet. As much as possible in a society to take care of children, we should let schools do the thing that they're best that, which is educating children. And then we should have other parts of our society that take responsibility for making sure that children and the families of young children have enough food and are fed and are housed and are connected to the internet and so forth. I mean, one of the things that we're seeing in the pandemic is the extraordinary importance of schools to the social safety net for young children. And it's too much, you know, the amazing thing about schools is you can ask them to do all these things, and educators are so unbelievably devoted to the children in their communities that they'll do them. They'll figure out how to feed kids. They'll figure out how to pass out hotspots. They'll figure out how to buy Chromebooks. But it's not the right and the most efficient way to prepare young children to be successful adults in society.
That's right. And so when is a country like ours going to provide free internet? You know, countries like Lithuania, you know, have free internet for everyone. And what is keeping this country from it? It seems like we're just going to fall farther behind in terms of what the government does to contribute to the education of our children with internet.
Well, we have a tremendous faith in the free market to solve problems, and there's lots of things that conceivably the free market is good at, but when we identify services that we think ought to be treated as utilities, ought to be widely available to people, we need to figure out a way to move and ship those things. Now, there, you know, the companies that control broadband access work very hard to write laws and to write regulations that make it difficult for municipalities or states to be able to provide, government-sponsored alternatives. So part of what we need to do as a citizenry is come together and say, you know, looking at the yawning inequalities that we see with school-age children in the pandemic, how do we want this to be different in the future? This is not going to be the last pandemic that we face, and with rising, changing world from climate change, it's not the last disruption that we're going to face to schools either. There are going to be more schools that are closed to extreme weather event, extreme heat, fires, those kinds of things. And we need to build a schooling system that's more robust to those kinds of disruptions.
Justin, you're the director of the MIT Teaching Systems Lab. What do you do there at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Teaching Systems Lab?
Yeah, so one of the things that we've observed is that school systems all over the world want to see more ambitious teaching and learning in schools. They want to see less recitation, more active, engaged, student-centered learning. And the only way that we can make that happen is if we can dramatically improve the quality and quantity of the teachers. So we try to build the future of teacher education. We have a series of online courses. We're running one right now called Sorting Truth from Fiction, Civic Online Reasoning, which teaches effective search skills to teachers and their students. We create digital clinical simulations that let teachers rehearse for and reflect on important decisions of teaching. Part of the lesson behind, or part of the theme behind all the work we do is we say, let's use technology for the things in which it is most well suited. So it's, as we're learning, it's very difficult to create technologies that effectively replace the interactions between elementary school teachers and their students. But we do know that already educated, already affluent people are more likely to be effective at learning online. And one group of folks who meets those criteria, who works in the public interest, are teachers. Teachers lead enormously complex lives, and part of their professional life is being able to learn. And so we want to create learning experiences for them that they can fit, you know, through online learning into their complex schedules, and then figure out how they can take these new skills and integrate them into their practice in the classroom. So as much as we're sometimes critical, and the book Failure to Disrupt is critical of efforts to try to transform everything in education with technology, we do think there are lots of places where we can say, look, this is a targeted area where we have a group with some learning needs, and some skills that are well aligned with online learning, and some tools that we can build to help them.
Justin, we have listeners this morning who have dropped their kids off at college and recently, and maybe they're involved in a percentage of their schooling online, or maybe their kids are in high school or in middle school. What advice would you have for those parents so that they can counsel and support their kids?
That is a great question. I would say, as much as possible, encourage children to be partners with their faculty. Many faculty right now, millions of them, K-12 teachers, millions more in higher education, are trying to figure out how to make this work. And none of us have all the answers. But young people do have a unique perspective. You know, there's exactly one generation of young people that has been to school during a pandemic, and it's the students who were in our classrooms last spring and this fall. So I've encouraged faculty very much to try to partner with their students, and I hope students will partner back to have discussions about what are the most effective ways in our own particular context of building really good learning environments, and how can we keep figuring out, you know, in the midst of these ongoing closures and disruptions, how to do that better. You know, unfortunately, there aren't a lot of like quick tips and tricks for being a better online learner. There are things like doing your very best to create routine schedules and to create spaces, you know, that work for you for learning, with, you know, the right amount of quiet or background noise and the right amount of ability to focus. Those kinds of things, though, they're not instantaneously discoverable. They take practice for us to learn how to develop the structures and the routines and the focus that help us be good online learners. I would say that the other thing maybe is that, given this idea that oftentimes people do a better job learning online when they really care about what they're learning about, as students are selecting courses for this semester, I might recommend that you save your requirements, save the things that you really have to do for when you're more likely to be back on campus and have some more supports around you. Maybe now is a good time to choose a bunch of electives, to choose courses that you think you'll really be able to dig into, even if the online learning feels kind of hard.
Justin Reich has written Failure to Disrupt, Why Technology Alone Can't Transform Education. Justin, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we've really enjoyed this conversation, and we enjoyed your book.
Thanks so
Justin.
Much. It was a pleasure.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.